Is there something wrong?
Warning. Life support failure on all decks. Abandon ship.
Maybe it is time to take command.
Bridge to captain.
Join Jan Shaw and her guests as they discuss cosmic creating and the path to reclaiming our power as cosmic creators.
Library computer, data being received.
To go where too few have gone before. A production of Cosmic Reality Radio. And you're alive.
Thank you, Nancy. Welcome to this week's Cosmic Creating Show. It's August 31st, 2019. My name is Jan Shaw. Happy Labor Day weekend, everybody who's listening. And today's show is going to be a little different from usual. If you've listened to previous shows, you'll know that I often include snippets of information about my incredible experiences with my Andalusian horse and other horses, actually. And what he taught me about the nature of fear and how to overcome it, about energy and energetic communication, about how childhood experiences can destroy your self-confidence and how to rebuild it, and how manifestation works. Well, today I'm going to tell the whole story about my journey to consciousness with the horse. So I hope you enjoy it. In the first half, I'm going to be really focusing on the horses that have come into my life and why that happened. And in the second half, I'm going to focus on the teachings and how it applies to our own personal and spiritual development. So I hope you'll garner some useful information that will help you with your journey to consciousness. And so here we go. So I have been in love with horses, I think, from the day I was born, even though I might not have been completely conscious of it at that point. One of the first photographs of me with a horse was on a huge Shire horse, this little tot perched on top. And it was actually at the farm of one of my father's cousins. And me and my brothers used to go and play. We'd go up in the hayloft and play up there. And in those days, which was still in the 50s, horses were still used on the farm for ploughing and so on. And I think the fact that I was perched on the horse was confirmation that my journey was going to involve a lot of horses. I think the second photograph, again, I must only have been maybe 4 or 5. I was dressed in this old style pair of jumpers, which had the massive kind of hoops around the thighs. And that's quite an amusing photograph in terms of the difference in what we now wear to ride horses. I can't remember ever riding at that point, actually. The photograph was real. But my recollection is that I didn't actually ride. And when I was 7, my father left and I never saw him again. And of course, at that point, my mum was a single parent and couldn't afford riding lessons. But just to go back a step, when I was 5 or 6, the family moved to Norwich in the UK. Of course, I was born in the UK. And we lived in a little village called Blundell. And my father worked for Courtaulds, which is one of the biggest cotton manufacturers in the UK. And he was moved to a job in Norwich, and we were given a company house. And that was quite an experience, because I was born in a very small kind of terraced house in Blackburn, Lancashire. And this was a big detached house. And interestingly, it even had a servant's bell in every room. So you could actually call a servant. Well, I have to say, we didn't have servants. But this particular house was on a third of an acre of land. And it was right next door to a dairy farm. And my eldest brother, he was really into farming, and actually he went on to study farming at agricultural college. But we used to go over and visit the farm, and because there was no access to horses or ponies, I took it upon myself to make friends with one of the calves. And I actually started riding a calf. I was so desperate to have something to ride that I actually ended up with a calf, which, if I look back, it must have been quite a bizarre sight to see this little 5 or 6 year old sitting on this calf and riding around the field. So that, again, was one of my earliest experiences with horses. So fast forward to when I was a young teenager. And I was so desperate to ride that I used to bike up to the local riding school, and it was a couple of miles away. And I used to work for rides, so I'd be mucking out and cutting up carrots and all sorts of things so that I could actually have a riding lesson. And that was my first love affair with a horse. I used to ride a lovely little Arabian horse called Natasha. And she obviously made a great impact on me because I still remember her to this day. But the interesting thing about Natasha is that she was my first experience with what I would call a hot blood. An Arabian horse is a very sensitive horse, tends to be very high spirited. And sure enough, I was riding in an indoor riding school, but she would often take off with me down the school, and I used to absolutely was definitely a fan of the spirited horses rather than the plod along horses. And that was a really great experience. And again, I continued to ride at the riding school. I didn't actually get my first horse until I was 29. And this is when I was living in the Midlands. I was working in IT at the time, one of my early jobs as a business analyst and programmer. And Milton, which was the name of the horse, was a beautiful Anglo-Arab. So he was a cross between a thoroughbred and an Arabian. So again, no surprise that I should go for another hot blood. The interesting thing is that I have always been attracted to these spirited horses, but no coincidence, every one of them, certainly from the when I got my own horse, had fear issues and confidence issues. And I remember going to a cross-country event with Milton, and we had to go over a water ditch, and he just did not want to go. A lot of horses don't like water until you train them to be okay with it and confident with it. So I remember having to get off the horse, jump over the ditch myself, which then encouraged him to jump over it, and then I could get back on and continue the rest of the way. I only owned Milton for a couple of years because then I married my second husband and became pregnant with my first daughter, so I couldn't really manage the horse and the family. So that was when I sadly decided to sell Milton and return to a more sedentary life, if you like. Interestingly, at that point, I was living in Milton Keynes. So interesting that my horse should have been called Milton, and I ended up in Milton Keynes. And that's not the first time I had a connection with Milton Keynes, but more of that later. So Milton had to go, unfortunately. But within a few years, I managed to start combining the family with riding horses again. I was, again, living in the Midlands, and there was a local riding school close by. So I thought, right, I'm going to start riding again. And so I would go and have riding sessions there. And this particular riding school had actually rescued a horse that had been maltreated. It was suffering from malnutrition, really skinny. But with the right treatment, it really blossomed into a beautiful horse. And because I'd had quite a bit of experience riding by then, the owners asked me to work with the horse, which I took as a great compliment. So I would go up there and I'd ride the horse and train the horse. And then I moved to another riding school. And the horse, I actually saw a notice on the notice board looking for somebody to share a horse. And so I approached the owner, and this particular horse was called Dante. And she was a young mare. She was only 5 years old. And again, had some quite interesting issues in that she was very nervous. I remember the first time I actually rode her in the indoor school, and she took off around the school at a great pace. And I thought, oh, another one. This is interesting. She was actually a thoroughbred cross. So again, thoroughbreds tend to be pretty flighty and high spirited and so on. And she was no exception. And there was another person who also answered the ad to share the horse. And I think she had one ride on Dante and decided that she was too much to handle. So I actually took on this part loan of Dante at this riding school. And one of the things that I get great satisfaction from is actually developing horses and improving them and training them. And Dante was very nervous around strange objects. And I remember one occasion when I was actually walking her around the riding stables and getting her to approach objects that she found really scary. And I remember somebody, another rider, coming along and saying to me, "Why on earth are you bothering with that horse? Why don't you get something that you can actually ride properly and that isn't a handful?" And I thought, actually, I don't want one like that. I really love the challenge of building a horse's confidence and getting them to accept these challenges. And I'll go more into that a little later when I get to the story about my Andalusian and how I approach these things. So I used to hack out, as we say in England, and of course, not having the wide open spaces there, I was limited a lot of the time to riding on roads. So Dante had to get used to being in traffic and having cars passing and so on. But I did get to ride on bridle paths now and again. And again, Dante would be walking along the bridle path and she would just stop dead in her track. She obviously thought she saw something amongst the trees or in the woods or something like that that was scary or threatening. And one of the things that if you approach horses in the right way, you definitely learn patience. And I remember I would sit there and nudge her forward with my legs, and but often I would just sit there until she decided that it was safe to move on, and reassuring her that it was okay. And another time I was riding along the road, actually with my daughter on her pony, and this particular route went past a slaughterhouse. And we were quite a way away from this slaughterhouse. And I think she must have smelt blood from the from the slaughterhouse. That's the only thing I can think of that would have made her react in the way she did. And with Dante, she didn't react explosively. What she would do is she would just stop dead in her tracks, as I explained on the bridle path. She would just stand still and refuse to move forward. And at the time, I found this extremely frustrating. And I have to say, it's one of the times that I didn't behave in the way that I would behave now, or in a way that I'd be proud of. And I got really cross with her. I think in the end, I had to get off and lead her rather than ride her. She wouldn't continue down the road, even following my daughter's pony. So it's a case of, well, what can I do to resolve this? Well, the only thing I can do is get off and walk her along the path, along the road. So that worked. I got back on. We rode past the slaughterhouse, and that that episode was over. So I must have had Dante for about 4 years, I think. And at that time, my second husband and I had bought an old cottage that had been extended to make it into a 5-bedroom home. And it had always been my dream to have acreage so I could have my horses at home. And this particular cottage had 3 acres, and it had an old barn at the back of the property. Now, when we moved there, we didn't have the barn was not suitable for stabling the horses. And at that time, I still had Dante. And we also had a pony called Tango, who was a little chestnut Welsh pony that my daughters rode. And so across the road, and this was a small village in Leicestershire in the UK. And across the road, very conveniently, was a boarding stable. We call it a livery stable in England, but I'll use the American term. So I would graze the horses in my paddock during the day, and then I would take them over to stable them at night across the road in this boarding stable. Well, one day, the people that owned the riding stable, the livery stable, the boarding stable, were riding horses down the road. And I happened to spot this really lovely looking grey horse that was being ridden. And that horse happened to be stabled directly opposite where my horses were stabled, my horse and pony. And I'd see him looking out of his stable door and watching whatever I was doing. And I never really gave it a second thought. Now, at this point, I was working still in corporate IT. I was working as a project manager for the largest catalogue retailer in the UK, which also happened to be in Milton Keynes. Funny how the Milton Keynes and the Milton themes keep cropping up. So I had a very long commute from Leicestershire. It was like an hour and a half each way. And I was running a multi-million pound supply chain project at that point, which was introducing a new merchandising system and integrating it with all the existing legacy systems. So it was a pretty challenging role, and I was in charge of about 6 other project managers from both internal and from external consultancy, one of the big consultancy firms. So my days were pretty long, but I was still determined to make time with my horses. And it was the Easter of 2003 when I decided to take a few days off. And in the UK, we have a magazine called Horse and Hound, and it's every horse person's favourite magazine for horses for sale. So I was flipping through these pages. And at some point, and I can't remember at what point this happened, but I'd had in my mind that I would really like to own an Andalusian. And the reason for that is that, again, Andalusians are the hot bloods. They're known as Baroque horses. And I'd always loved Arabians, but the Arabians in England were always pretty small. They're only about 14 hands, 14 two hands, which is only just about on the verge between pony size and horse size. So what I wanted was something that was very similar to an Arabian, but was bigger. Anyway, this particular day, it was I think it was Good Friday, because Horse and Hound always came out on a Friday and I had a subscription to it. And I was flipping through the horses for sale ads and I saw this ad for an Andalusian. And I looked at the phone number and it was a local code. So I thought, oh, I'll go and have a look at this horse. So I called the number and I was talking to the woman that answered. And I suddenly realized that I was talking to the owner of the boarding stable. And it was, oh, Joe, it's you. And I couldn't believe that this horse was actually at the stable. And when I went over to see the horse, I discovered that it was the very same horse that had been watching me from the opposite stable in the yard, as we call it. So I tried the horse. I fell in love with him immediately. And within less than a week, he was mine. And his name was Milda Voto. And he was known as Voto. And he was only a 4-year-old, soon to be 5, and a beautiful dapple grey. So I have to say, even then, I was struck by the coincidence or the synchronicity of this horse showing up on my doorstep, because never would I have imagined that a horse that I had wanted would, in effect, be delivered to me. And I think that's exactly what happened. But as you hear the rest of the story, I'm sure you'll realize, as I did, that this was definitely engineered for the two of us to be together. It turned out that the horse was owned by the mother of one of my daughter's school friends who lived in the next village. And she had sent him to the boarding stable to get some additional training in preparation for being sold. So I knew this person, somebody who was very involved in dressage, and didn't know her particularly well, but I discovered more as the story goes on. So as I say, within a week, Voto was mine, and I was just so delighted with having my Andalusian. And just a bit of a backstory. Growing up, I'd read every book I could get my hands on about horses. I'd written fiction books. I'd read fiction books. I'd read non-fiction books about riding and training. But it was always very much from the point of view of what's known as the British Horse Society. And the attitude and the approach to training horses was very much about, you're the boss, you know, the horse has to do what you say. And if the horse doesn't do what you say, then you put pressure on the horse. And this was my style of riding. You know, I'm confident, I'm the boss, I can make a horse do anything, and so on. Well, of course, I started riding the horse. And I would take him out on the road, and we close to the close to my home was what was known as a byway, which is an ancient trail that I think the old wagons used to use. And it was nice to be able to ride up there because we could get off the road. So one day I was riding down this path, and as you rode down into a dip, you came to a ford in a stream. And one of the things that became obvious was that Voto had a real issue with water, and he would follow other horses through. So that was the way I approached it, and everything was okay for about the first 9 months or so. And then one weekend, I decided to go on a cross-country ride. And again, I took my daughter on her pony. And there was a very nice big log in this field that was just perfect for jumping. So I thought, right, I'm going to jump Voto over this log. So I was cantering up to the log. And as we got very close, Voto suddenly reared up into the air. And I slipped off the saddle, slipped over his back, and ended up on the ground, totally startled by the fact that this horse had reared. And in the horse world, there are certain what they call vices that people tend to avoid when they're buying a horse. And one of those is rearing, and the other one is bolting. And I was so stunned that this horse should rear like that. It was totally out of the blue. I'd never had any indication that he would do that. Anyway, I got back on and continued the ride. But this was the first sign that there was something going on with this horse that wasn't quite right. And shortly after that, I was riding down this this byway with my daughter and one of her friends from the boarding stable. And we got to the ford in the stream, and I asked Voto to go first. Well, he reared again, and this again was indicating to me that this horse had an issue, which concerned me, because even though I'd done a lot of riding in my time, I'd never had to deal with a horse that reared. I've dealt with bucking horses and, again, never truly had a horse that would bolt, which is really an uncontrollable gallop. You know, I'd had fun galloping around, and but always feeling in control. So I continued to ride, and often I would ride in the field at the boarding stable. But what started to happen was that I would feel at times as though I was sat on an unexploded bomb. The tension in this horse was so great that I felt that he was about to lose control of himself at any moment and pose a really serious physical danger to me. And I was getting to the point of feeling like I was losing my confidence with him. And I've always been a confident rider. You know, I've always loved the challenging horses and, you know, the ones that have the spirit. But this was a totally different thing. And Voto was a big horse. He was over 16 hands and very powerful. And this power was becoming a real threat and a danger to me. And I was really starting to get very upset about the fact that my dream horse was turning out to be more of a nightmare than a dream. And I remember going home after finishing my horse chores. And sitting down and talking to my second husband at the time, in tears because of what this horse was doing and how he was behaving. And he said, well, you really love this horse, so why don't you try and get some help? So I thought, right, this is what I need to do. I need to get some professional help to help me understand why the horse is behaving in this way. And I'd started to get interested in natural horsemanship. And it was when it was really starting to become popular and people like Pirelli were starting to run clinics, and they also produced online or CD-based training and so on. And I used to subscribe to a number of horse magazines, so I'd read these articles about natural horsemanship. So I thought, maybe I need to get a natural horsemanship expert. So I contacted one of the UK's leading natural horsemanship trainers. And I won't mention any names in this case because although I didn't speak to him directly, A, the cost was phenomenal. And B, when I mentioned the fact that Voto was also had issues on the road with big vehicles, like buses would go down the road and tractors and things like that, and he would react pretty badly to those. The response was that, oh no, we don't deal with anything like that. So I thought, okay, I need to look elsewhere. Well, I happened to be an article in one of the horse magazines, which was about a man called Mark Hudson. And Mark Hudson worked for one of the UK's horse rescue organisations, which was based in East Anglia. And he was employed by them as a natural horsemanship trainer because their philosophy was, well, if we can help horse owners with horses that have issues like this, then they're less likely to end up in a rescue or in the wrong hands. And so it's kind of a preventative measure. So I contacted Mark Hudson, and this was, I think, the following May. So I'd bought Voto in April of 2003, and this was in May of 2004. And by this time, I'd had my barn renovated and converted into two stables. So I had Voto completely at home with me, which was perfect. And he came along on this particular day with his assistant, who was also his romantic partner. And I explained the problem to Mark, and he started working with Voto on the ground in the paddock that he was normally turned out in. The weather wasn't perfect for this. It was a very, very, in the words of Winnie the Pooh, blustery day. The wind was blowing, and this didn't exactly help the situation. But anyway, Mark started doing this groundwork to really assess his personality and to assess his behaviour. And he was putting quite a bit of pressure on Voto to really see, you know, how he would respond to pressure, not in a physical way at all, but more in what he was asking him to do. And I was sat, I think on a stool or something, watching this. And I remember clearly that as Voto was being circled around Mark, he came past me and he kicked out with one of his back legs, as if to say, what on earth are you subjecting me to here? I really don't like this. Anyway, a little later, Mark asked me to saddle up Voto so they could see how he behaved when he was being ridden. And so I saddled him up, and Mark's assistant got on Voto and immediately got off. And she said, I'm not riding him. And I'm thinking, oh, what does this mean? So they said, well, you get on him because he's, you know, he's familiar with you and so on, which I did. And I could feel, again, this incredible tension in his body. So I was focused on really walking him quietly and trying to make him feel calm. And after a short ride, I got off and we finished the session with Voto, and I was then given by Mark his assessment of this horse. And I knew I had a problem, but I hadn't quite realised how bad it was. And Mark told me that Voto was so dangerous that he could kill me, kill himself, or kill both of us. And that he was just like a wound up spring, wound up to the tightest. And this was why I was feeling so much tension in him. And the feeling that he could explode at any moment. And when a horse of that size and that power explodes, it really isn't going to be very pleasant and pretty dangerous, really. So his comment was, well, you have three options here. You can sell him. And immediately I thought to myself, well, nobody's going to buy a horse in this condition because he's just not going to behave in a way that will make people feel confident that they've got a horse they can, you know, they can ride and do things with. He said the second option is have him put down. Well, this is my dream horse. And even though he was obviously dangerous to ride, he was one of the most affectionate horses I have ever known, actually. He would greet me with a nicker and, you know, he was always pleased to see me. It was only when he was put under what he felt was pressure that his behavior changed. So Mark said, well, the third option is that you can rehabilitate him. And what you need to do is you need to go right back to square one and you need to do groundwork with him every single day. And his recommendation was that I put obstacles out in the field. I would use a blue tarp to get him to walk over the top and get used to that, and basically using groundwork to build his confidence before I even thought of riding him again. Well, my reaction to that was, well, there's no way I can sell this horse, and there's absolutely no way I can have this horse put down. So I decided that I was going to take on his rehabilitation. And as I said earlier, at the time, I was doing this really pressured, stressful, demanding job with a long day of commuting. And at the time, it was like the worst thing that could have happened, that my dream horse should get into this state such that I had to do all this work with him to make him rideable again and have to work every single day with him. But I was so committed to this horse that that was the only thing that I could do. So I would start, I would get home from work probably 7:30 in the evening, immediately go down to the field, catch him, and then start doing this groundwork with him. And there were some very interesting situations there where I would have the tarp on the ground and I'd be trying to lead him over and he would just flip his lid, to use an English term, and I would be knocked on the ground. I did always wear a helmet and I actually always wore a body protector as well. But you know, we had so many instances of him just not coping with what was asked for. So I continued to do the groundwork every single day. The people at the boarding stable were very much not in the mindset of natural horsemanship, and the owner's husband, I know, made a comment that was something like, how are you going to get a horse to get better if you just walk him around? And I thought, yeah, he doesn't get this at all. And I'd also heard of a situation before the barn was renovated that I was told about by another of the horse owners there. It was when they would bring Voto and the pony in from my field and walk them up the road to the boarding stable. And on one occasion, I think there'd been a big vehicle come past and Voto had reacted to it. And I was told that the husband was leading him, and his idea of getting a horse to behave was to hit it. And I heard that he hit the horse, he hit Voto, and Voto slipped on road and went down. And I was absolutely furious about this, because there is no way that that is going to help with a horse that has confidence issues. Anyway, outside of the work that I was doing with Voto, I'm the kind of person that if I have a problem to solve, I will research till the cows come home. Again, another English term. I will just research and research and learn. And I decided I would learn everything I could about natural horsemanship, and I would learn everything I could about equine psychology. And I would also look into some of the background to Voto before I got him, and figure out what it was that had caused him to have to get into such an emotional state of being triggered into panic, into real fear. And this might seem obvious, but I hadn't considered at that point that horses are prey animals, and so their natural instinct is fight or flight. One, their whole psychology is about self-preservation. So their natural response in the wild to anything that is threatening them is usually to literally go into flight mode and gallop away as fast as they can. And, you know, in fight mode, if a horse is in a confined space, then that's the only other option. So I started to learn about this, and also about some of the natural horsemanship techniques of training and how horses naturally respond to things. And I won't go into all the detail of that, because I really want to get on to what was the most fundamental and
Jan? Okay, we seem to have lost Jan here. I don't know what happened. She said she was having internet problems, so I'm going to put
out...
Oh, there she is. Okay, Jan, we lost you for about a good minute. And we lost you again.
Oh, really? Oh, sorry about that.
Okay, it's not your fault. I'm sure it's your internet. You're back now. So whatever you said a minute ago... You had just said you weren't going to get into the details of what you wanted to
okay.
Focus on what he was dealing with, I guess.
Yeah, what I wasn't going to do was focus on, you know, the details of the training methods, because I really want to get into what was the really impactful and significant aspect from my point of view in terms of my relationship with this horse. And I was reading everything I could lay my hands on. I loved the books by a natural horsemanship trainer called Mark Rashid, and he lives in Estes Park, Colorado, and he wrote quite a number of books that told stories principally about how he dealt with challenging horses through his career. And one of my favorites was Horses Never Lie, The Heart of Passive Leadership. And it was a very influential book, not only in terms of how I work with Voto, but in terms of my leadership role in my corporate job at the time. And it really was very significant in my understanding of how horses relate to other horses. And we have this view that, oh, the alpha in the herd is always the one that the horses follow and go after. But through Mark's work with horses, he was saying that they don't want to be with a dominant horse or an aggressive horse. They want to be with a horse that is supportive, that is nurturing. And I thought that's a very interesting concept, especially when it comes to working with horses, not to be overly dominant or aggressive towards them. And I've seen many horse people do that, sadly. And also, it works just as well with people. But the point I want to get to is one of the books that I was led to read was called, or is called, The Tao of Equus. And it's written by Linda Cohenhoff. And it's the story of her emotional rehabilitation through the horse. And she'd been in a very abusive marriage. And she owned this Arabian horse. And she told the story of her experiences with this horse, who actually turned out to be unrideable because of an injury or a physical issue. But the significant part of the story was that she started feeling like she was being haunted. She was hearing things and feeling things. And what she discovered was that she was being haunted by her ancestors and the horses of her ancestors. And she was originally from Eastern Europe, and of course that's where shamanism originated. And what this did was it triggered this really irresistible urge on my part to look into reincarnation. And I remember sitting in front of the TV one evening and thinking, I just have to do a search on reincarnation. And this search became a breadcrumb trail. It first introduced me to the Buddhist concept of reincarnation. But somehow, and I can't even remember the detail of how, it led me to a course by Joe Vitale, who was one of the stars who appeared in the movie The Secret. And this was an online course that was teaching about the law of attraction. And at the time, I was going through a lot of very challenging circumstances, not just with my horse, but with my husband at the time, with family issues and financial issues as well. And this concept of the law of attraction was a completely new concept to me, the concept that we can create our own reality. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic. You know, I never thought of doing this. And I told my husband about it, and he said, oh yeah, we must try this. I really committed to practicing this concept of focusing on what you want, not what you don't want. And it really led me, this introduction to the Linda Cohenhoff book and to reincarnation and the law of attraction, was 100% what started me on my spiritual journey. And this horse that was delivered to my doorstep was the catalyst for this awakening and for this exploration into a whole new dimension of learning that I had no conception of before this happened. If I hadn't been looking for books to learn about my horse and how I was going to heal him, I would never have come across this reading matter that led me to open up on a spiritual level. So this experience that at the point that I was told how dangerous he was, I felt was the worst experience of my life, turned into the biggest blessing, because this horse was responsible for what has happened to me since 2004. And so really, to just continue the story of this, and I don't want to run over the first hour because I do want to get into some of the principles behind this. I continued to work with him on the ground. He started to get more confident with the obstacles that I was using, flapping carrier bags and tarps and anything that could be scary, I would gradually introduce him to until he accepted it. And then I got to the point where I could actually ride him again. And there was one critical point that I will always remember. And this was after I'd started riding him, and I would still have sessions where he would just get really tense again and get that feeling of an exploded bomb again. And, you know, I was still very conscious that this horse still had a long way to go. Well, one day I arranged to have a lesson with my dressage trainer, and she was so helpful to me because she really had an empathy with horses and had a very gentle approach to training. And on this particular day, I'd arranged to have this lesson, but to share the lesson with a friend who I'd started riding out with. And so this lesson was being held at the boarding stable, and they had an arena behind the barn, which was surrounded by high bushes. And you had to get into the arena between the wall of the barn and a big hedge to the left. So it was only a small opening. And I had had many times when Voto just did not want to go through this opening, and I would eventually manage to encourage him to go through. On this particular day, we went through into this arena, and he was, again, extremely tense. He felt like he was going to explode, and I quickly came to the conclusion that he wasn't rideable at that particular time. So I decided to get off. I led him back across the road to my barn. I took off his saddle and bridle, and I put on the halter that I used when I would work with him on the ground. And I took him back to the arena across the road. And I took him down to the far end of the arena, which seemed to be where he was fixated with, that was causing his fear and anxiety. So I'd learnt about join-up techniques. Monty Roberts is a great proponent of that. So I got Vivroto to circle around me. And when he started to come in towards me, if he didn't come all the way towards me, I would send him out again and around the circle. And we got to the point where he stopped in front of me, several feet away, and he just turned and looked at me. And I have to say, that was the turning point in our relationship. It was as if he recognized that I was not a threat, that I was his leader and his security. And we literally stood looking at each other, probably only for a minute or two. But it was a moment of absolute connection between us. And I've never forgotten that moment, because I could so easily have lost it if I had just made the horse continue on in the circle. But it was as if I knew instinctively or intuitively that this was a very significant moment. And from that point on, things started to improve. And we started to do dressage competitions, and we started to do, you know, I would be able to take him out on his own, and he would actually meet obstacles with confidence, a trust in me that he'd never been able to do before. And that to me was so rewarding, because it showed to me the strength of our bond. And I remember one particular time I was riding along the road, and there had been some roadworks, and they'd put a steel plate across the trench that they'd dug in the road. And I walked up to this steel plate, not wanting Boto to walk over it, because metal on metal shoes would probably cause him to slip and frighten him. I was just curious to see how he would react. And instead of reacting explosively or fearfully, he actually stopped and thought about it. And he got to the point of being willing to walk over this steel plate. Well, I didn't let him do it, because I knew it wasn't a good thing to do. It was just that moment was another confirmation of the level of trust that we had built between us through this very challenging period of building his confidence and building his trust in people again, to the point where we were able to have fun together and ride through fields and gallop through fields and go to dressage competitions. And there is a lot more to the story than that. I still had some interesting experiences that, you know, if he got excited, he could buck like nobody's business and I'd end up on the ground. But because of the bond, you know, it would be one experience. We were riding through a stubble field after the harvest, and it was after I'd been on vacation for a couple of weeks, and he got excited at the prospect of galloping through this field and put this huge buck in, and I ended up on the ground. But the point is, this horse never ran away. Any time that I came off, and believe me, I came off many times, he would always circle back to me, and he would look down at me as if to say, "What on earth are you doing down there?" But to me, that is indicative of the bond and the trust between us. And I know that because I was riding with the friend that was going to have the dressage lesson with me. We were riding in a field, and I was cantering ahead of her, keeping an eye on her horse to make sure we didn't get too far ahead. And her horse suddenly took off and circled around, and she actually fell off, and the horse just took off and headed for home. And I thought, that is so interesting, because that's something Voto never did. He would always stay with me. And that gave me so much reward for all the trauma, the heartbreak, the upset, the challenge of working with this horse, knowing that we had this incredible bond between us, because I had given him his confidence back. And that is what meant the most to me. And so in the second half of the show, I'm actually going to talk about the principles of how I did that and how it relates to people just as much as it did with this horse, because he has provided me with so much learning and experience and information about the nature of fear and the impact of losing self-confidence and about energy and about manifestation that I now use with my clients. And it's a very, very useful analogy to help people understand the concepts by using examples of how I've used this with horses, and helps them to understand how they can change their behavior, how they can build their self-confidence, and how they can be in charge of their energy and of their thoughts. So it's the top of the hour. I'm going to take a breather, have a drink, and I'll be back with the second half of the show in a few minutes.
3 minutes, 45 seconds long enough?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, so you're standing in the middle of the thunder and lightning. I know you're feeling like you just can't win, but you're trying. It's hard to keep on keeping on when you're being pushed around. Don't even know which way is up. You just keep spinning down, round, down. Every storm runs out of rain, just like every dark night turns into day. Every heartache will fade away, just like every storm runs out of rain. Tell yourself that there's something more, and walk out that door. Go find a new rose. Don't be afraid of the thorns, 'cause we all have thorns. Just put your feet up to the edge, put your face in the wind. And when you fall back down, keep on remembering.
Nancy, welcome to the second half of this week's Cosmic Creating Show. I'm Jan Shaw, known as the Success Alchemist. And in this half of the show, I'm going to really go through the way that my horse taught me so much that has enabled me to do the work that I do now with people in terms of understanding fear, letting go of fear, being in charge of their energy, being in charge of their thoughts, developing mindfulness, and also becoming cosmic creators, masters of manifestation. So I want to start by just talking about the nature of the horse and how it relates to the nature of humans. And as I said in the first half of the show, the horse is a prey animal. And of course, the humans in some cases are known as kind of the ultimate predator. And so that is a very different energy from the energy of the horse. As I said, the natural response to fear in a horse is fight or flight. And in the psychology of the human, we have what's called the amygdala, this kind of the reptilian brain. And that has the same response as the horse, as the horses, when under stress, under pressure, in fear, in that we run away from situations, or ego takes over, and the ego is fear-based. And so the response, the natural response from the ego in those situations is very, very often anger, aggression, dominance, a lot of negative behavior that is used in self-defense. So there is that similarity, and the antidote to that is developing mindfulness. And it's interesting because I often say, well, I would prefer to use the term mindlessness, because this is really about slowing down the thought process so that you develop the ability to respond rather than react. And by being aware of your thoughts and emotions, you are in a much better position to be able to control those emotions and get to a point of deciding, choosing consciously a response that is positive rather than negative. And this is whole essence of consciousness. This is why I talk about my journey to consciousness with the horse, because it was through him that I developed the consciousness to choose responses rather than to knee-jerk react to situations. So let's just talk for a minute about the nature of fear. And there's a very common acronym that's used for fear, which is false evidence appearing real. And I have a different acronym. And the reason is because, to me, the very word evidence implies that what you're fearful of is real, and that there are facts to back up that fear. Whereas in most circumstances where both the human and the horse experience fear, it's actually not something that is a physical threat. You know, when I used to ride around the countryside in Leicestershire, there weren't any tigers or mountain lions or anything else that would be considered to be a physical threat in the undergrowth. But the perception of the horse was that there was a threat there and they would then react to it. Most of the time we experience fear is, according to my favorite acronym, false expectations appearing real. And the reason that I use that is because what we're doing is we are imagining some negative experience that is going to happen in the future. Because in most situations, people are thinking, oh, well, I'm not going to succeed in this, or I'm going to run out of money, or that person isn't going to like me, or any spectrum of negative thoughts that people think could possibly happen to them. And it's the could possibly bit that is key, because in that moment, it's not happening. Therefore, it's not real. It's happening sometime in the future, and that future has not arrived. So it's only a possibility, an expectation, not a reality. And one of the things that I learnt when I was training Voto to overcome his fear was that if I dropped into fear myself, and of course we have a vivid imagination, don't we? I could have imagined the horse bolting with me, the horse rearing, me being thrown off, me being injured. Even, I mean, it's not unknown for people to be killed in riding accidents. And so if I had allowed that fear to overcome me, that would have communicated itself to the horse and made the whole thing so much worse than it was at that moment. And so what that taught me, and this is where I want to bring in this whole concept of energy and energetic communication. We often look at, you know, we see so much in relation to humans and in relation to natural horsemanship that is very focused on body language. And body language is very important. The horses use it between them. They have signals that say they're not happy or they're aggressive. You know, they change their facial expression. They put their ears back if they're angry and aggressive. And we can also use body language with horses so that we're not projecting that predator energy, body language. We are projecting a much softer body language. But what is very rarely talked about in the horse world is energetic communication. And I actually have I created a website back in 2013 called Energetic Horsemanship at energetichorsemanship.com, and I talk about this and how we communicate energetically. And horses naturally do that in the herd. And not only that, but they can pick up the energy of danger or potential predator, even when that predator is not visible. And to use that as an illustration, I'm sure many of you listening have watched documentaries about Africa and how you will see zebras and wildebeest and antelope grazing often by a waterhole. And there is a lion or a pride of lions walking past. And these prey animals, the antelope, the zebra, the wildebeest, they're just carrying on grazing and drinking. And that's because they pick up the energy and intention of that predator and know that that predator is not currently hunting, which means that they're not in danger. But if they are put in a position where it's obvious that the lion is hunting, then it's a totally different response. You know, that's when the flight mode sets in and they all take off and run away as fast as they can. And we can also communicate energetically, and the horse will intuitively pick it up. So when I was in situations where I could feel the rising tension in my horse, I would consciously calm my energy and I would focus my thoughts on the outcome that I wanted to achieve. And I can give you a couple of examples of that. I talked in the first half about the horse that I had on loan originally and then eventually bought her, Dante. And at the time we were at a boarding stable where to go on a hack, as I call it, on a ride, I had to cross a motorway bridge. And underneath, of course, there's lots of traffic going and, you know, a lot of noise from the traffic. And I would be at the point of knowing that this horse wasn't that confident. I would almost imagine that she was going to go crazy and I'd end up getting thrown over the motorway bridge and land amongst the cars, you know, multiple feet below. And I realized that if I did that, I'd be in big trouble. And she was the first time, it was the first horse that I really started to use my energy to influence the horse and to calm the horse down. Of course, when it came to training Voto in his emotional state, this was absolutely essential, so that I had to communicate to him a feeling of calmness, not of fear. And this is, you know, the first illustration of the principle of manifestation, is that you get what you focus on. And again, these principles I learnt in practice in the work with my horse. So had I focused on fear and on possibly what might happen if he did explode beneath me, then there's a very high possibility that that would have actually happened. But by focusing on calmness and calming my own energy down, that averted that kind of disastrous situation from happening. And another example of that is after I sold, or my husband and I, second husband and I, sold the cottage with the land, I moved Voto to a boarding stable, and it was on a farm. And on one particular day, we had the opportunity to ride in a field that we didn't usually ride in, because it was usually being grazed by cattle. And this particular field was kind of long and narrow, and it had a very steep incline. And at this point, I knew that Voto absolutely loved galloping up hills. So I rode him to the bottom of the hill, and I could feel him getting really agitated and excited about galloping up this hill. And the last thing I wanted was for him to get so excited he'd start bucking, and boy, did he have a good buck. So what I did was, I didn't tighten the reins, I didn't tense up, because I knew that would make him worse. What I did was, I relaxed and I visualized in my mind my horse being soft and compliant and calm, and without doing anything on a physical level, his response was to completely soften underneath me. And in the horse world, when horses are in that state, they'll drop the head, they'll come into a real state of compliance. Some people call it submission. I don't like that word, because it implies some element of force when you get something to submit. So I prefer the word compliance. And I asked him, when he softened in that way, I said, just wait. And I said, okay, let's go. And we had the most beautiful controlled gallop up this hill. And again, that was a real revelation to me, how well visualization actually worked, because I'd use visualization combined with energy that reflected the outcome that I wanted to achieve. And it was almost like magic happened, because that's exactly what happened. Okay, so the point about fear is, we first need to be aware of it. We need to acknowledge it. It's not about ignoring it. It's about acknowledging the awareness, so that we can actually consciously choose how we are going to respond to it. And if we respond by focusing on the problem, on the actual fear itself, what we'll create is an outcome that reflects that, which can be disastrous on various different levels. or we can choose to focus on the outcome that we want. And that's the principle that we must follow when we want to be successful at manifesting that outcome. Okay, so the other thing I want to talk about is, again, about what I mentioned earlier, is about the present moment. Being in the present moment is the only moment that we have, and it's where we can make those conscious decisions and where we can choose what action we need to take, what response we need to have to a given situation. And one of the things that, again, I had to learn in my training and rehabilitation of OTO was I had to be absolutely present, aware to the nth degree, so that if I let my mind wander, I could end up again in a very dangerous situation. I had to be conscious all the time of his energy, of the surroundings, if there was going to be something that was likely to upset him, to put him into fear or panic. I had to be ready to intervene to prevent any disaster from happening. And, you know, the thing about the present moment is you really step into your power in that moment. If you're thinking about the past and thinking, oh, this didn't work, and oh, you know, this time I fell off the horse, or this time I failed at that, then you're preventing yourself from actually acting proactively in the present moment. And the same goes with the future. As I said, fear is something that's in the future. If you're in fear of the future, it can actually paralyze you, because you get so focused on the problem that you can't do anything practical or proactively to deal with whatever that fearful thing is and actually prevent it from happening. So the present moment is really critical to a raised level of consciousness. The awareness of what's going on in your head, the awareness of what's going on around you, the awareness of what's going on with the horse between your legs, all of those things is critical to safety and success. Now, the other thing I want to talk about is perception. And this is really interesting, because not many people recognize this about horses, but because horses are prey animals, the structure of their head is that their eyes are situated on the sides of their head, because that gives them a much more panoramic view of their surroundings. So they're much more capable of spotting a predator, spotting danger. They do have a blind spot right under their nose where they can't actually see anything. So if you're ever around a horse, don't approach them straight ahead, because they might not even see you until you're on top of them, and then they could jump on top of you in surprise. But it's interesting in the sense that if you walk a horse one way and they are perfectly calm, they're seeing the view through on the right hand side with their right eye only, then if you walk them in the opposite direction, when they see this same view with their left eye, they're seeing a totally different picture. The brain doesn't connect the two together as the same situation, which is why you can walk a horse one way past an obstacle and it's absolutely fine, and you walk the other way and it's seeing it through the other eye and it reacts completely differently. Now, this is a great lesson on perspective, because what the horse is seeing are two different perspectives on things. And we see things with different perspectives. And this is one of the things that is really important when it comes to this challenge of self-confidence. And I want to just come back to, I mentioned about how in the introduction, how early experiences, childhood experiences, and in my horse's case, early experiences as a horse can either build self-confidence or can shatter it. And I personally went through many situations in my, you know, very young days that completely shattered my self-confidence. I have a favourite story of when I was in, just started at primary school in England, and I was asked to take in things to sell at their fundraiser. And I'd asked my mum to get things out for me, and she hadn't done it, and she hadn't done it. And it came to the day when I had to take these things in. So I thought, right, I'll do it myself. So I got all these things out of my toy box and some books and toys and took them into school. And when it came to assembly time, I was pulled up in front of the whole school and effectively told I was stupid for taking in things that they couldn't sell, because I'd taken in books that had crayoning in, and I'd taken toys that perhaps were broken or whatever. And that was absolutely shattering to me. It was humiliating. It was embarrassing. I was being belittled, told I was stupid. And that was the source of the belief in not being good enough that I held, for decades, I have to say. And I had various other very unpleasant experiences at school, because I never felt like I fitted in. But in those days, you know, they would sit you on a stool in the corner with a dunce's cap, which I was subjected to on several occasions. And these are the kind of experiences that create these subconscious beliefs about ourselves, that no matter what we aim to achieve in life, if our subconscious is saying, oh yeah, but you're not good enough, oh, but you're stupid, oh, you couldn't possibly do that, then that is what directs our behavior. So we don't take the action. We don't set the big goals. We limit ourselves because our subconscious tells us that we're not capable of anything greater than that. So that is how we develop these limiting beliefs. And when I did the research into what had happened to my horse to make him lose his self-confidence completely, I discovered that he went through parallel kinds of experiences. So, as I said, I knew the mother, the owner, who was the mother of my daughter's school friend. And she was basically fearful of horses. And so she would become overly dominant. And with a sensitive horse, that creates fear in them, obviously. But she also approached she had several horses, but she would keep them separate. So when her horse is a foal, and she got him when he was 6 months old, he was separated from his mother very early and taken to a completely strange place. And then he wasn't given the companionship in the same field as other horses. And horses need the support of the herd in order to build their self-confidence in terms of learning good horse behavior and so on. And if you think about it, that's very much like what we as children need. You know, we need a supportive family. We need people around us who can teach us the right way to behave and, you know, build our self-esteem through encouraging us and letting us explore things and learn new things and getting praise for doing that. So if we don't get that, if we don't have that supportive environment, if we have a very dominant or authoritative environment that basically focuses on negative reinforcement, and not positive reinforcement. So you get told off whenever you're naughty, but you never get praised whenever you're good. That in fact, doesn't give you the foundation for self-confidence and self-belief. So how do you actually overcome that? Well, this is about a real step-by-step process in terms of doing things that support the growth of self-esteem. So in terms of the way that I did this with my horse, what I had to do, and again, this is a principle of taking things in the tiniest steps, a real baby step. So when I used to ride my horse in the arena at the boarding stable that I'd moved him to, I would see people come in and they were interested in dressage, and it was obvious from what they were doing that they'd set some huge expectations, not only for themselves but for the horse they were riding. And the expectations were beyond the capability of the horse at that time, and probably beyond the capability of the rider, because if they'd been capable, they would have recognized that these expectations were not reasonable. And I would see them ride in the arena for maybe an hour and come out of that arena frustrated, angry with the horse. The horse would be miserable because all he got was criticism. And the whole experience was really unpleasant. And most people ride for pleasure, so why would they do that? Well, what I learned was that I had to build this horse's confidence step by step by step. So I would enter the arena just wanting one step of progress from the previous time. And what I would do is, again, a principle of neutrality. If the horse didn't do what I wanted him to do, I would not punish the horse. I would be neutral. I wouldn't respond to it at all. When he did something that I wanted him to do, I would praise him. I would give him a treat. I would show him that he'd done a really good job and that, you know, I was really proud of him. And again, this, another principle here is communication. If we're not getting the outcome that we want, we don't blame the horse. We don't blame the people. We don't blame the universe. We have to say to ourselves, okay, so I didn't get the response that I wanted. Maybe I'm asking in the wrong way. Maybe I need to change the way I'm communicating. And I always used to joke about this to people in the horse world, saying, you know, the horse hasn't read the manual. You know, if you read horse riding books, oh, if you use this, you know, put your legs in this position, use this aid in this way, this is what the horse will do. Well, every horse is different. And in the same way, every person is different. So if we're not getting the right response from a person, we need to think about whether we're communicating in the right way to get that response. So we're taking on personal responsibility for our communication and for the outcomes that we get. And this is so important when it comes to leadership and building relationships. Okay, so step by step, approach everything in the same way. Success comes from the smaller steps. As Lao Tzu said, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. But so often we set these goals, which is great having big goals, but we make each step a huge leap, and we expect to make these huge leaps in progress, and then we get disappointed because we haven't achieved it. And we also are prone to procrastination. Oh, well, I need, you know, I've got, it'll take me a week to do that, and I don't have a week right now, so I'll do it when I have got time. Oh, it'll take me an hour to do that. And I don't have an hour right now, so I won't start. And the weeks pass and the months pass, and you're no further along the journey to that success than you were so many months ago. And there's a great book called One Small Step Can Change Your World, and it's the Kaizen Way. And I can't remember at this moment who the author is, but if you search for that title on Amazon, you'll find it. And this was something that was developed by the Japanese, and I think it was used in one of the big car plants like Toyota. And it's, the principle is, what is the smallest step you can take towards your goal? In horse terms, what is the smallest improvement that I can get in this session? And what that does, it not only stops you from not trying, from procrastinating, it also gives you something to celebrate every single step. And that is so important. Building your self-confidence, in building your self-esteem, building your sense of achievement rather than beating yourself up because, oh, I still haven't done this, or that was really hard because you were trying to take on too much. So I apologize for going all over the place. I'm just following these threads as they come to mind. So I want to go back to perspective again, and I've talked about the horse and seeing things through their eyes separately. And the thing about perspective is we can see things in totally different ways. I mean, if you think about a situation, multiple people can interpret the situation completely differently, and it is about interpretation. Somebody can say something, and one person will take offense at that, thinking it's an insult, and another person will respond to it entirely differently. And it just illustrates the fact that there are unlimited perspectives we can take on every situation. And this comes back to how to regain self-confidence. And I want to go back to the story I just told about that experience in primary school, where I interpreted the experience of being humiliated and embarrassed as being a reflection of me, that I wasn't good enough. Many years later, and I'm talking about probably almost 15 years later, no, maybe not as long as that, maybe 10 years ago, I was introduced to this concept of perception, and I was shown a way to look at this situation completely differently. And what I saw in that situation was an absolute opposite of how I'd interpreted it as a five-year-old. And it was that, well, you took initiative. You were 5 years old, and because your mum didn't come up with the things to take to school, you took the initiative and got the things yourself. You took responsibility for that task being given to you as a five-year-old, and you took the action necessary to achieve that task. So that turned my whole perception of that situation on its head, and also changed the perception of myself, that I had been good enough, that I had shown qualities as a five-year-old that were to be celebrated, and that the fact that the head teacher hadn't seen that, hadn't perceived that, was not my responsibility and certainly not my fault. And this is what I do with my clients, because everybody has limiting beliefs to some degree. And when we look at the things that have really impacted our belief system about ourselves, we look at those situations and we look for a different perception and interpretation of it, that can make a huge shift in our belief system about ourselves. And it has for clients I've worked with many times. And to return to the analogy of the horse, you know, you can, going back to the perception, even though they might see things differently from the two eyes and react negatively to one view, even though they react quite calmly to the other, you can influence that perception, show them a different view of that situation, and build the confidence to deal with it, just in the same way as people can do with their own issues. So one of my biggest focuses is on mindfulness, as I've said before. And it is possible to teach a horse mindfulness. It's a very interesting process because, as I said, you know, the typical reaction of a horse is fight or flight because they're a prey animal. But what I learned from my experience with horses is that they need time to think about something. They need to be given the time to respond to something and think about it, rather than being pushed into something before they're ready for it. And I've seen this happen so many times, in that, you know, on a physical level, horses' brains don't work in the same way that ours do. They don't connect things as quickly as we do, because they're horses and we're people. And if you give a horse time to look at something, to look at it through both eyes, to maybe sniff at it, to really work out whether it is really a threat or not, then you actually develop that ability to respond rather than react in them. And I even noticed that when I started jumping Voto, I could intuitively sense that when he approached a jump, he would actually be looking at it and thinking about it and using his brain, rather than just careering at it and kind of leaping without any thought at all. And this is so important for us as well. And I'm very much a proponent of what I call the power of neutrality. And the principle of neutrality is that everything in the universe is neutral until we assign an interpretation to it. So if we always start from a point of neutrality, that gives us the space and the time to really focus and on consciously choosing a perception that is in our best interest rather than not. And this is the way that, again, going back to this point about fear, if you approach something from a neutral point of view, you can choose to look at the outcome, which is the positive, rather than the problem, which is the negative. You can choose an action that takes you to that positive outcome, rather than choosing an action that puts you more into the risk of whatever it is you're fearful of. And if you give yourself time to respond to a situation rather than react to it, and allow yourself to consciously think about the outcome that you want, I can guarantee that you're going to create a lot more successful outcomes than if you'd reacted to something. And I'm sure we've all done that, you know, we've done something and then thought afterwards, why on earth did I do that? And it's because we didn't give ourselves enough time to respond and consciously choose the best approach to whatever the situation might be. Okay. So it is possible to develop that mindfulness. It is something that is a gradual process, because you're retraining your brain. And what you're doing is you're actually slowing down the thought process. I know so many people complain about the fact that they've got the monkey mind. You know, their thoughts are racing so fast that they can't make sense of anything, or they get extremely anxious, or they get under stress. And I love the analogy that I use with people is again, going back to horses, it's like a bolting horse. And if you when you've developed this awareness, you'll notice immediately if a negative thought is coming up or a negative emotion is coming up. And if you then shift that thought or emotion before it runs away with you, then you'll be in control of where your thoughts are directed and what emotions they generate. So, as I said, like a bolting horse, if you don't do something, as soon as you feel that a horse is about to go in flight mode, it's much easier to stop a horse before they get into gallop. If you let that horse run away with you and really get the bit between his teeth and get, you know, racing so fast to get away from whatever it is that has frightened or panicked him, the chances of stopping are much, much reduced. And it's the same with our minds. How many times have you had a negative thought and suddenly that first fearful thought, oh, you know, I'm not going to have enough money at the end of the month. And then it goes to, oh, I won't be able to pay these bills. And, oh, you know, I won't be able to pay my mortgage. And, oh, I'm going to lose my house. And, oh, then my marriage will break up. It snowballs into all of these bigger and bigger problems that you're imagining. Whereas if you'd stopped it at the first point of, I'm not going to have enough money at the end of the month, to, well, okay, what can I do about that? All right, maybe I need to cut my spending in this area. Or maybe I need to do something to earn some extra money. Or maybe I can sell something on eBay or something. Look at the difference between reining that thought in versus allowing it to run away with you. And this takes practice. It's taken years of practice for me, but it becomes your natural response. And I got to this point with the horses as well. I was training horses on an Arabian horse ranch in Austin, Texas, and I had one horse who had a lot of emotional problems, and sometimes he would just flip completely and start plunging and bucking and twisting. And I became able instantly to shift my attention to the outcome, the calmness, being in control. And it does become second nature. Even if second nature to you at the moment is the monkey mind thoughts running away with you, you have the power to change that. You have the power to develop that mindfulness, to develop the ability to respond, not react, to develop the ability to focus on outcome, not on problem. And that gives you the ability to manifest, to take the action that's necessary to move you towards that outcome in the smaller steps and manifest the outcome that you want. And letting go of the fear, letting go of the problem, just let it go. Don't attach yourself to it, because when you do that, you feed energy to it. And when you give something energy, it grows, it expands, it becomes powerful. If you don't feed energy to it, it loses power. The lights go out. You can't switch on your TV because it hasn't got energy. If you feed it energy, the power comes back on. So by focusing on what you don't want, you're feeding energy to the very thing that you want to avoid. Whereas if you focus on the outcome, you're feeding energy to the very thing that you want to create. Okay, so Nancy, I think I've run out of topics here. Would you like to ask any questions about this?
It's brilliant. Seriously, I was really. It's a brilliant way of explaining things because you take it out of the human realm and you put it into the horse realm. Brilliant. Questions? I don't know.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me
I wonder if there's any questions in the chat room.
Let me look. Well, you're looking at it. Why don't you look?
There aren't, because I'm there aren't any at the moment. So.
Well, it's Labor Day weekend. I don't know how many listeners we'll have, but they'll ask when they're watching the YouTube.
Absolutely,
what does she mean by that?
Yeah.
Or maybe not, because
I could go into more, but I think I'm into brain drain now after nearly 2 hours of talking.
Okay, hold on. Let me just turn off the air conditioner because I was sitting there just listening.
Well, okay. I hope those of you who are listening have enjoyed it so and found it useful. Okay, Nancy, you're back.
Yeah. I've had experiences with the horses. The thing about a horse, I suppose, different than some animals, although maybe a frog, I had the same kind of thing with them, is when you look in their eyes, it's like there's a deep, deep energy in, you know, you go, what, who are you really? You know, you're a horse here, but who are you really? And what you're touching on is, you know, that they're not very much different than us, if much at all. You know, and the concept.
No, and actually, it's interesting because there are a lot of natural horsemanship people who say, don't look in the horse's eyes because you're a predator and it'll be threatening to them. And actually, that is total BS because, you know, it's rather like the movie Avatar, which I absolutely love, because it almost encapsulates what I was explaining as the bond. You know, when they bond the horses, like mane or whatever it is, with their own hair, and it forms a bond when they ride this, whatever it is. But and that's what you can get when you're riding a horse, if you really tune into them. And I've had experiences when I was riding Voto, it almost felt like we were one entity. We were so connected. But the other thing in Avatar is they say, I see you. And this is what I used to do, not just with Voto, but with, you know, every horse I met, is that I would look, and it's just like everything. You can look at somebody in a threatening way, or you can look at somebody in a really soft and loving way, compassionate way, nurturing way. And I would, my first approach to horses is to connect with them eye to eye, because the eye is the window of the soul. So, you know, I would be thinking to myself, I see you, and the horse would be seeing me. And so that would be the opening gambit of whatever the relationship is going to be, that interaction with the horse. I had a very interesting experience once at a dressage competition where I'd parked my trailer with my horse in it, and I went to the stewards to start, you know, to check in, and I walked past this trailer with a little Arabian horse tied up to it. And as I walked past, it nickered at me. And I thought, that's odd. I don't know this horse. I've never seen it before. And then I walked back and it did it again. And I thought, that is really strange. So I thought, well, I'll try it one more time and just see if that happens again. And it did. And I went up to the horse and I said hello to it, and then the owners were in the car and they were kind of looking through the wing mirror, so I thought, well, I better leave the horse alone. But I think, again, it's about picking up people's energy, and So many people have this really busy energy, or they're stressed or anything else. And when you learn to control your energy and calm your energy, which creates that inner peace, that communicates. And I think that's what happened on that particular day. So this is why I think energetic communication is so important as well.
Well, you know, you mentioned that the horse had led you to looking into reincarnation. And do you feel that that some of these horses you have a past with in other lifetimes?
Well, that could be so. I mean, I always joke about being a horse in a previous life. And yeah, could well be.
Because when I was...
I hadn't actually thought about it that way, but yeah.
Because Gene has Jack the Watcher, who was why we got together, as you were following Gene. And yes. one day she emails me and she says, Jack is mad at you. And I'm going like, why is Jack mad at me? Because you lost the Olympics. And I'm going like, Jean's comes, you know, so I get a hold of Jean. She said, well, apparently, because I believe that I'm, that a reincarnated experience of mine was George Patton. And she says to me, well, Jack is saying that George Patton rode him in the Olympics. And I was like, George Patton was at the Olympics? I mean, I thought I knew everything about the man. And all of a sudden, I'm going like, what is this about? So I start to think, oh my God, I was more concerned with the fact that I didn't know why I didn't know that George was in the Olympics. And she says to me, now he's saying that your horse or George's horse didn't make the trip to Sweden, and that you got permission to use a Swedish Army military horse, and you were in the stables walking through and walked right by Jack, and Jack reached out and essentially bit you. And I said, oh my God, where did he bite me? And she says, he bit you on the, and she stopped to listen to Jack, and she said, left shoulder. And when I was like 10 years old, about that time, a horse came up behind me and bit me on my left shoulder. And it didn't quite bleed, but it left the teeth marks, and it was bruised. And I thought, whoa, you know, this is, and then we confirmed that yes, in fact, George Patton was at the Swedish Olympics on a horse, and they lost by 1 second. And what Jack was so mad about was that the horse, Patton had never really rode this horse before, and the horse made a move, and Patton thought he was stumbling and corrected. And that correction cost a second on the time, because the horse wasn't stumbling. He was doing a move that Patton had never felt before. And so Jack had always held this grudge against George because he lost the... So, I mean, we never know, you know? We never know what kind of relationship is really the basis of it all.
No, and as, you know, as you were saying about reincarnation, on my show with Lorna... a few weeks ago, of course, Voto came through to communicate. And that, you know, I've known without needing it stated, but I know that he was sent to me by divine, whatever. That was a relationship that was meant to be. And, of course, he confirmed that by saying we went back thousands of years in multiple lives, and we're going to meet again. So there's no reason why I can't have other relationships with other horses that have been in past lives, I guess. I think the one between me and him is very special. But I think I've had many experiences with different horses in this life, so I'm sure it will continue.
Yes, life continues. Okay, so we're at the end of the show. You want to give them your contact information? And it was a brilliant show. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. And yes, you can find me at thesuccessalchemist.net and also on Facebook and YouTube. Just search for Jan Shaw, S-H-A-W, The Success Alchemist. And you can read a bit more about the story of energetic horsemanship at energetichorsemanship.com. So thank you, Nancy, for producing again and for coming in at the end when I ran out of juice. And also to everybody who's listened today. And I hope you'll be with me for the next Cosmic Creating Show. So bye for now.
You have been listening to the Cosmic Creating Radio Show with Jan Shaw, a production of Cosmic Reality Radio.
Live long and prosper.